1 Corinthians 18, verse 1, 18 to 25. The message of the cross is foolish to those who are headed for destruction, but we who are being saved know it is the very power of God. As the scriptures say, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise and discard the intelligence of the intelligent. So where does this leave the philosophers, the scholars, and the world's brilliant debaters? God has made the wisdom of this world look foolish. Since God in his wisdom saw to it that the world would never know him through him, human wisdom, he has used our foolish preaching to save those who believe. It is foolish to the Jews who ask for signs from heaven, and it is foolish to the Greeks who seek human wisdom. So when we preach that Christ was crucified, the Jews are offended, and the Gentiles say it's all nonsense. But to those called by God to salvation, both Jews and Gentiles, Christ is the power of God and the wisdom of God. This foolish plan of God is wiser than the wisest of human plans, and God's weakness is stronger than the greatest of human strength.
Thanks for that reading, Seth. I'm juggling a few responsibilities this morning, so that's why I'm moving a little more hurriedly. We have an interesting time that we're living in. Seems as though we have a different set of responsibilities than we used to. When I talk to young men, young couples about whether or not they're ready for marriage or whether or not they're ready to have children, a lot of times then we find out what the expectations are, what they feel like they need to have in place before they can have children. And sometimes you'll hear a man say, I'm not strong enough to be a father. I'm not strong enough. It seems they have an expectation of strength. They have memories of their own, of the things that their father did, and strength was a defining characteristic at that time. And for me, it was no different. How strong does a father need to be? Well, for my father and my grandfather, the expectations were quite clear. My grandfather moved up with his whole family, a whole van full of kids and then some, and they went to work wherever they could find work. And so my grandfather worked in the lumber mills of BC, and you've got to be pretty strong to work in the lumber mills, especially 50, 60, 70 years ago. A lot of times they would come here to do farm work. And you need to be pretty strong to work on the farms, especially in the days before unions, before a sort of mandated one day a week off kind of thing. My grandfather did physical backbreaking work. And the understanding was clear that this is what he had to do as a father. Other things that I might feel like I needed to do weren't really a part of his priority list. But these are the things that made him a good father. And if there's ever anything wrong with the car, well, that's the father's job. Not to take it somewhere to be fixed, to fix it yourself. That was a real man. That was the understanding. Anything in the house that needed to be fixed, that was also the father's job. My car has been gradually getting louder, and anybody who's driven close to me recently might have noticed this. So when I took it in for a semi-regular oil change, they always kind of look around at a few things, and I said, have a look at the exhaust. There's something wrong. It might be the muffler. Because I had changed the exhaust manifold myself. A while ago, I paid a mechanic to replace some of the exhaust pipes, so I thought, well, maybe by now it's gotten to the muffler. And I figured that's what they would tell me. I would buy a muffler from them, and I would fix it. Well, I went back, I paid for the oil change, and they said, listen, there's a bolt that's broken on your exhaust manifold. We're going to have to take it off. We might have to re-drill something. It could be a pretty big deal. Now, this was disappointing to me, not only because it was going to be a lot of money, and not only because my car is old enough, it's hardly worth doing anything to it, let alone spending $1,000 on a repair, but I had fixed the exhaust manifold myself. That's a big deal for me. And it was sort of funny because I diagnosed it myself, I ordered the part by myself, and I put it on by myself. All of these things are uncharacteristically mechanical of me. Normally, I pay somebody else to do it. But I looked at it, and I thought, I can do this. I have tools. I have a garage. And I have an internet connection. You see, there were lots of times my dad would criticize me for being inside on the computer, and probably a lot of times I deserved that. But I don't think he would believe me now if I told him that if I want to fix something, I search on the internet and it tells me how to fix it. Not only does it tell me how to fix it, there's a YouTube video of somebody doing the exact repair that I need to do. So all of the times my dad said I shouldn't be sitting on the computer, I was learning the skills to find the information that he was trying to give me. Now, he taught me how to fix his car, and technology changed, and cars improve. And so when I need to fix something on my car, I can't just do it the way that he did it. I have to do it differently. And I'm able to use the computer to do that. And so now, for me, the expectations of being a good father are different. And the ways that I use strength as a father are different. And so if I could find a little icon of an IKEA wrench, maybe that would have been one of my symbols that I put here. Because when we buy furniture, it's my job to put it together. This is the kind of narrow slice of our lives where my strength is relevant. Also, if there's a bottle or a jar that needs to be opened, that falls on me, the strong one. I should have done this next week when Anna wasn't here. Also, if there's a bug in the house that sometimes don't look at her. She's not as brave as she thinks she is. I do a lot of reading, right? So the things that my father and grandfather did that made them strong, that made their strength relevant, were a pretty significant part of their lives. But for me, physical strength is less and less of a requirement. And if I have money to pay a mechanic, if I have money to buy pre-assembled furniture, then there's even less of a slice of our lives where my physical strength is relevant. But if we take that same question and we put it on God, how strong does God need to be? Well, then it becomes a much more difficult question. And we will look through the scriptures, especially the Old Testament, and we will find a number of examples where God has to overcome, overpower. God has to defeat something or someone. And so there's an ongoing, eternal conflict between God and Satan. It's not eternal. We believe there will be an end to it. But there is a conflict where we know God has to fight against Satan. God has to overcome evil. And when there is evil in our worlds, we know that God is with us. God is fighting on our side against that evil. And in other parts of the Bible, it says that God is on our side against the principalities and powers. And so if God's enemy is the powers, God himself needs to have power. The forces of darkness rise up against us. Some of this becomes a little bit poetic. Some of these are names used for the same things, but it communicates that there is situations where God needs to have strength. God needs to have power. God needs to exude force in his life, in our lives, in our world. But what does that strength, what does God's strength look like? From time to time, if I talk to people about peace and how I believe that God came, God sent Jesus to bring peace to this earth, they will point me to this passage. And I could have chopped it up a little bit and made it a little bit more accessible, but I will turn around and sort of point out the little passages. So this is a passage from the book of Revelation. And just like some of those other expressions, the book of Revelation is full of poetic explanations of what's going to be happening. And so the book of Revelation presents to us a final conflict. Final conflict between good and evil. The final conflict between God and the armies of God and Satan and the forces of Satan. And so this is the passage that comes at the end of that conflict, the culmination of that conflict. And so it gets a little bit poetic, like I said, a little bit flowery, but here is John, the writer of Revelation, and he has this vision of this conflict coming to an end. And so at the end of the conflict, here is a white horse coming in. The battle is over. The white horse has arrived. And on the white horse is a rider. And the rider's name, it says here, is Faithful and True. And it doesn't go on to name the rider beyond that right away. But then it explains what the rider does. He judges. He makes war justly. His eyes are like a fiery flame. On his head are many crowns. It goes on to explain a lot of symbolism, because how does one wear many crowns at once? We know that this is someone who is now in charge of many nations. But in verse 13, it says, He wore a robe dyed with blood. Some translations will use a different word there than dyed. It might be soaked or covered in blood. So here is the victor coming back from war, covered in blood. Having won the decisive battle, the victor is covered in blood. How can this be a man of peace? And then it goes on to talk about, in verse 15, let's see here, a sharp sword that he will use to strike down the nation. So this is the contrasted image. We have a Jesus who preaches peace and love of enemies, but then we have